Welcome, members of the ICANN board. We will start the meeting in just 1 minute. Give us 1 minute and we'll start the meeting. Right. If we could, are we ready to go with the next session? Thank you. If I could have your attention, everyone in the room, we're about to commence the next session, which is a GNSO working session here in London with an opportunity for the GNSO to meet with the ICANN board. Ching. It's great to have you here. Thanks. I guess I'd like to extend a personal welcome to you as a Londoner and as someone who never sees weather like this, which is what I said to the council yesterday. And so it's mildly depressing to be stuck inside a room, but hopefully we can enhance the quality of being stuck inside the room with good interchange. As you know, these are our GNSO weekend sessions on a Sunday. We've actually, by a combination of accident and design, ended up with a very well-structured day. We met with Teresa Swinehart this morning, and that was immediately followed by a discussion with Fadi, in which we covered some of the critical topics of the moment, including the top three items for Teresa, and that led neatly into some of those flowing over into our discussion with Fadi, and then on to talk about some other issues, some of which we'll touch on now. We met with the Global Domains Division. I want to call them the Generic Domains Division, but the Global Domains Division, with Akram. For the first time, we met with all Akram, Cyrus, Christine, and Chris, so that was very useful. We've then gone on to talk in some more detail about NTIA stewardship transition and accountability issues. So I think we've had, and now we've finally had the expert working group on who is in a session just prior to this. So it feels like we've had a very good warm-up to meeting with you. And on that note, I apologize that the room is a little warm. Yesterday, in true style, it was a little too cold. We were all frozen. And so now it's a little too warm. Maybe tomorrow it'll be all right. So, welcome, all of you.
Jonathan, the statistician will tell you if the one leg is too cold and the other one's too warm, then on average, you're comfortable.
Maybe it is all right, then. On that positive note, I wanted to start with a couple of slides talking about recent achievements and so on before we dived into the detail of some issues which we were flagged with you over the last 24 hours. Before I do so, Steve, is there anything you would like to say in any sort of opening remarks or any comments?
Thank you very much, Jonathan. The usual, it's a pleasure for us to be here. We take these interactions quite seriously. We want them to be substantive. We want to get to the heart of whatever is on your minds as well as on our minds. The temperature is already warm, and I'm expecting it will be perhaps yet warmer by the time we're done. So let's just plunge right in. There's a lot of content, and it's a mix, successes and some things that are perhaps less so. And, of course, we're meeting with you today as the council, and on Tuesday we're meeting with the various different parts of the GNSO. So it's a sort of combination process that so we get a lot of different facets of interacting with the GNSO. I note, looking around the room, that the ICANN board is interspersed almost perfectly with other people. Must be you guys. And so this is good. So we can all talk to our neighbors and increase the bandwidth here. Take it away.
Thanks, Steve. So I wanted to, I've got two slides here. I'm not going to take a lot of time. I wanted to say this for a couple of reasons. One, because I think it's useful you hear directly from us what we've been up to, but we don't want to spend a lot of time on that. Second, we have a culture here, and it came up to some extent this morning, but we have a culture of kind of criticism. At times, very constructive criticism, but often criticism for its own sake. My suspicion is we hear a lot of criticism about you, the board, and the senior staff, and various things. I suspect you hear criticism about us, the GNSO Council and the GNSO. I don't think everything's perfect within the GNSO by a long way. I don't think the council functions like a perfectly well-oiled machine. But I think we do a lot of things well, and we spend a lot of time working on thorny issues and trying to make good progress. And I'd kind of like you to know that, so you hear that element as well as the criticism, and so there's some sort of balanced perspective. So in a sense, it's in that spirit that I prepared these two slides. And so the first one talks about some strategic objectives, and these are worded as they were conceived back in Buenos Aires when we had what we called a council development day. It was the first time, as I said to you on a previous occasion, it was the first time we'd got together as a council and had an induction and development session, the kind of thing you would naturally do in most team-type situations, and something which we had never done, at least as comprehensively as that. What we came up with were some core objectives, which we will re-evaluate in full at the end of the year when we meet again for a similar session in at the LA at the annual meeting. And we hope and believe that it will be a useful meeting to do on an annual basis, both for checking strategic objectives, but also for naturally inducting new councillors, because that's when the changeover in the council takes place. So we targeted an effective working relationship with the GAC, the demonstrable efficiencies and effectiveness of the council, an ability to attract new volunteers to the GNSO working groups, to have your acknowledgement, respect for, and appreciation of the work that is done in the GNSO, which was a very sensitive subject, and I personally feel we've made some progress in that respect, and for us to have more substantive discussion in between our meetings. Don't forget, we meet every 3 to 4 weeks on a regular basis, dealing with substantive work and making a decent throughput through the work of the council. I'm not going to go into any kind of deep dive on any of these topics. For me, it's important to highlight to you that we are thinking strategically, we are trying to develop the way in which we work, and that's really it, to record that. And I'm happy to have any discussion on it, but that's really the purpose of this slide. Next slide, please. The second is to give you a little highlight of what's been going on since Singapore, and this is, I know you get briefings, you've probably had briefings on policy, and certainly some of you will be very close to one or more of these issues, but it's no bad thing that you hear it in a little composite from us. So really one of the critical issues in this whole organic structure that is the multi-stakeholder model is effective interworking between some of the silos, whether those are within the GNSO or within or across community. And as you well know, that one critical area is ensuring that the GAC is properly engaged with GNSO policy, We've made tremendous strides in the work that we've done through what we call a consultative group. We deliberately didn't call it a work group. It's a consultative group between the GAC and the GNSO, and one of the outcomes of that, there are others, but is a proposal to produce a liaison from the GNSO to the GAC so that the GAC is regularly and frequently informed on work going on in the GNSO, in particular that might have public policy implications. And so we have on the table for the GNSO and for the GAC a proposal to institutionalize, at least on a trial basis for a year, a liaison to the GAC, and at first a first step in that direction. You know, we had a thorny decision, which I neglected to tell you in my communications, although I'm sure you are well aware, came out on a knife-edge decision on the Spec 13, but we got through it, and we navigated our way through it in a constructive and in a way that we didn't tear each other's eyes out and we didn't fall apart at the seams. We managed to navigate a genuinely challenging issue for the GNSO for all sorts of reasons I won't go into now, but we produced a constructive output. We've put input into the meeting strategy working group, the work of the multi-stakeholder innovation panel, for which, again, we had some challenging thoughts. So there's a number of things. There's clearly the initiation of the curative rights PDP and work going on cross-community working groups. There's also a particularly important initiative which has been well supported by staff on the progress on PDP improvements. We're well aware that one of the criticisms I referred to earlier was the speed and effectiveness of the PDP. There's a very natural tension between speed and effectiveness and efficiency versus due process. We've got to navigate that, but we're making progress and have a number of improvements that are on the way. So that's my sort of little positive entrance into our discussion. We can dig down into some of the points that we talk with you now. I want to do that. And there's one other thing I'd like to do, and I think it's very important in front of you, the board, because again, in this climate of regular criticism, we fail to acknowledge things and all that we perhaps should at times. And I'd like to acknowledge the tremendous support and this came out this morning, but I think it's important that you hear it as well, the support we receive from the policy staff that support the work of the GNSO in a spirit that is both goes well beyond the regular work of an employee. It's both positive, hardworking, and very, very helpful to us. So I think it is important that you know that, and we publicly acknowledge that. So that's my sort of introduction. Thank you for hearing me out briefly. And now, Steve, we can pick up on some of the other points that we shared with you by email.
Do you have that list in slide form at all, or you've got it on your screen?
I certainly have it on my screen. I don't know that it's available in slide form, so I am hoping it's been shared with you by email, and I'm happy to lead us.
I just wanted to ask a question just on what you've just said. Can you give, I don't know whether to speak a little bit more closely, can you give a bit of insight into how you prioritise work at the moment within the council? Because I'm certainly hearing, and I heard from the commercial stakeholder group this morning, that you know, they're struggling with just the huge workload, lots and lots of public comment periods and things to respond to, and presumably the council has similar concerns. Just interested to understand what prioritisation process you run to work out which topics to focus on.
In some ways, I wish you didn't ask that question, Bruce. When I came into the council, and prior to even taking on the chair, there was a sense of and what some people have talked about. There's a series. There's this perception of too much work, too much work, too much work. I then said, well, let's develop a mechanism for prioritization. And people said to me, you're crazy. We've been there before. It's a problem. You'll never agree. You'll just go down. And so I took a different approach at first and said, actually, let's just try and do things effectively, well, in an organized way, and focused on organization rather than prioritization. And for the most part, that's worked, actually. That's been very effective. I don't think we felt, in terms of what you might call our bread-and-butter work, our regular GNSO policy work, we have been overwhelmed. Now, a part of that, I think, is because the new GTLD program has been executed on the side, and that's taken a lot of attention away from the need to develop what I might call run-of-the-mill policy work. So I don't think our workload has been, and I think others may disagree with me, but I haven't felt our bread and butter workload to be overwhelming and therefore for a need to do that. What's changed probably over the last 6 to 12 months? I want to express this carefully because I don't want to but is a kind of wave after wave of apparent initiative, and that's some of various more broader issues, whether it's a number of different issues that have appeared to overlay on top of that and have almost been a distraction from the other work, and what's changed the dynamic from what it was. And some of those are ad hoc, small initiatives, and some of them are clearly the bigger picture stuff. But it almost doesn't matter whether it's expert working group, strategy panels, IANA stewardship transition, and when you lay all of those on top, that's what moved it from a tolerable steady state, I think. But let's hear from others.
I think this is John Berard with the business constituency. One of the things that helps the council get more done is that we're not involved in a public comment period. I mean, that's the purview of the constituencies and the stakeholder groups. And so that is a fair share of what takes up the time at the constituency and stakeholder group level. We have, in recent past, written short letters on specific subjects. But we have generally, we benefit from not being pulled into what is an ever-expanding and increasingly accelerated public comment period.
Okay. Try to use this one. The message that Jonathan sent out listed five big items, recent developments, which I think we've covered, board engagement and involvement with the community, GNSO board seats, an estimate of 25 minutes, another 25 minutes on expert working group on who is, and another 25 minutes on issues, recent developments were relevant with the ICANN model, and 10 minutes on IDN development and adoption. I would like to start, if I might, with the expert working group for a couple of reasons, one of which is you just finished meeting with them, and their delivery of their report basically puts the ball back into our court, the board's court, figuring out what to do next. So just a moment's recap of the sequence of events. We've known for a very, very long time that there were some deep issues with respect to the way WHO is structured. We took the opportunity in tandem with the receipt of the WHO is review team's report in 2012 to pursue a dual track of fully supporting the WHO is review team's recommendations and adopting those and directing that those be implemented, and at the same time opening up a fuller dialogue about is it time to go back to first principles, and if we did, what would result out of that. The expert working group was chartered. We directed, from a formality point of view, the board directed management to pursue this. This came out of a board meeting in November 2012, and in rapid order, the expert working group was convened, and Chris Despain and I participated on behalf of the board. I can tell you that it was an extraordinary effort, very, very intense, vigorous, a enormously talented set of people, and you met them, they were just here. The output of that is now the beginning of a dialogue, not the end. There may be people who expected that the natural sequence would be that report would be hardwired into GNSO for a policy development process. That strikes me as premature, but the big question that we need to ask is, where are we, what are our next steps, and one important input to that is, what is the GNSO's perspective. What not only what do you think of that report, but what do you need before you feel ready to tackle this? And any input that you have available, any guidance, and it doesn't. We can have some discussion now, but it also can be a thoughtful and more in-depth process. And we do not at this instant have a forced time scale. We don't have a forced procedure. We're back in sort of open field, if you want, looking for how to think about it. And in relatively quickly, we will pick a path. But I want to emphasize that our ears are wide open and we're keenly interested in what your reactions are without any sense of commitment. So that's a substantive discussion which I, among others, is very keen to hear.
Thanks, Steve. Any comments, questions, or input on this? And just a reminder to please state your name before speaking at the mic.
Chuck Gomes, well, like everybody else, I compliment the expert working group for an incredible amount of work and very constructive work, in my opinion. It seems to me that, you know, the next step is policy development, but that's a little bit of a trivial thing to say because I think there's a lot of policy development that's going to have to happen with regard to the many things that are proposed there. And I suspect this is a case where it'll be really smart for us in the GNSO to divide it up into some sort of meaningful segments to make it realistic that hopefully could happen in parallel. I don't know if we have enough resources to do it all in parallel or not. That would be more ideal. But I think a next task, if and when the board passes this on to the GNSO, is for us to put our heads together and figure out how can we design maybe multiple parallel working groups that maybe all come together at the end or something. I'm kind of thinking live right there, but this, I think, in my personal opinion, the work that the working group did will greatly facilitate policy work going forward and complementing that. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy or short because it's significant change, but I think breaking it up into parts will help make it more realistic.
Thanks, Chuck. I've got Avery next and then James.
Thank you. Avery Doria speaking, NCSG GNSO Council. One of the things that I, in reading that, and I must admit I've only read it once and read it quickly and not necessarily clever enough to have absorbed it all, but one of the things that people in the IETF, for example, have started working on is doing a privacy analysis, a privacy threats analysis from a protocol and technical point of view. You know, certain of the obvious things is our big data stores are our nice, juicy threat, privacy threat for pervasive monitoring and such as that. So one of the things I wanted to look at, and of course I'm sitting next to a person that can probably take this further within the board, is there any interest, request, however, whatever, to have an RFC 6973, a privacy analysis of the privacy threats that this EWG type of protocol, type of behavior, type of data collection might actually cause? And I'm not talking about policy, I'm not talking about privacy as policy. I'm talking about the protocol and data threats that this solution might engender. So that's just something I wanted to put on the table. Thank you.
And let me thank you for the very specific clarity about distinguishing the privacy policy from the privacy threats due to the structure and operation of the data store. I think that is a very, very key distinction, and both are very important, but they're separate.
Thanks, Steve. So we have a queue of questions and comments, but as you just did now, if there is an appropriate response, by all means come back. I don't want to just force us through a series of queues, and including from elsewhere in the room. So if someone wants to make a direct and specific response, by all means do come in with that. I've got James next, followed by Christina, Brian, and Elliot.
Hi, thanks. James Bladel speaking, North American Registrar. So I agree, the next step, the next big milestone for this body of work will be to feed this into the GNSO policy development process. But I think that there are a number of preliminary tasks that need to be completed before that can before that jump can happen. I think first, the assessment that Avery mentioned, I think should be done, but also coupled with perhaps some other feasibility studies and even a legal analysis, so we don't get into trouble like we did with WHOIS and all the different jurisdictions that are now tugging at that issue. It sounds like, and without going too deeply into this issue, it sounds like there's still a loose thread of a potential dissenting opinion from one of the working group members. Would love to figure out what if that's going to be published or folded into this final report, and then anything that's revealed through the public comment also I think needs to be merged into that. So I think there's a number of there's probably a big chunk of work that still needs to happen in front of this this report before it can even be considered fully baked and ready for a PDP.
Jonathan. It's Chris. Can I just briefly respond to James, if that's okay? So, James, thank you. I just wanted to pick up on your point about stuff to be done beforehand. This is very, very useful feedback, because one of the things that we need to decide is what stuff should we do before we roll it into a PDP, and what stuff should we leave for it to be done with the PDP. And one of the examples I've been using is legal advice. Should we say, you guys do that when you're doing your PDP, or should we give you that to start with? So that sort of discussion in the GNSO to come back to us with feedback would be incredibly helpful to work out the stuff you think we should get done before we give you the thing to do the policy on would be incredibly helpful.
Jonathan, can I?
James, come back on that, and I know Ray.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to preempt the queue. That's an excellent point, Chris. My concern is that if something does go into a PDP and runs into those roadblocks along the way, that there's a presumption that the PDP itself is somehow failed or was premature or something like that. So we can do it that way. It's just we need to be aware that that's one possible outcome, and we don't want to presume the outcome.
I think Chris was saying, tell us in advance all the things that you would like done to make the PDP process more likely to succeed rather than to run into roadblocks. So that's exactly what this dialogue is focused on. And this isn't the only opportunity, but it's the first opportunity to engage in that. And we're very, very strongly oriented toward listening to that, because we understand. In fact, the whole purpose of the expert working group, if you like, was to begin that process in a way where, from prior experience, we know if we just sent over to GNSO saying, who is this broken, please fix it, start a PDP, we've been there, done that multiple times, so that's why we chose a strategically different approach, and this is more of that we're continuing to execute on.
Thanks, Steve. We've got a queue, and I'm just going to make it clear who that is. And if someone has to come in immediately to respond so we don't lose a thread, let me know. But otherwise, we've got Christina, Brian, Elliot, David, and then Ray. Fadi, please.
To be very clear, especially after our discussion this morning, we're not going to do anything until we hear from you. Nothing. I'm not moving. Nothing top down. We're going to wait to hear from you. We want to be responsive to how we can make you successful. But we're not doing any feasibility studies. We're not doing anything until we hear from you.
Thanks, Fadi. Christina.
Christina Rosette, IPC. I would just add a step before the steps that James articulated, namely for the constituencies and the stakeholder groups to have enough time, frankly, to read and understand this really tremendous piece of work. I haven't read it. I've made it to page 10. But I think that's in large part because it was released, you know, not barely 10 days before the, you know, we all started traveling. So I think it's important, I think, for the board to understand that that process for the constituencies and stakeholder groups to read it, to understand it, to have the opportunity to take advantage of the sessions this week, to listen to how what the EWG is saying, listen to the questions and answers that are being presented, and then formulate their views as to what they believe should be the next steps in terms of PDP, which then will feed into the council. My point is, I just, at least from the IPC perspective, this is obviously an issue that is of significant importance to us. But don't expect to hear from us this week.
I suppose there's a worth making one brief comment on that there used to be some form of moratorium on new information coming out ahead of an ICANN meeting, and someone as experienced as Elliot would be able to tell me exactly what that was. I think it was 3 weeks. 15 working days, which is de facto 3 weeks. Yeah, I mean, another way of putting it.
This report carefully observed all that. This report was delivered 3 months before or 4 months before the ICANN 51 meeting in October somewhere.
Jonathan, just to take the heat out of all of this, let me just reinforce it. This is the first of a discussion. The fact that the report has been tabled, you're going to have meetings with the EWG to discuss it. Nothing will happen until we've talked, you've been through it, you've come back. So, Christina, of course, the constituencies in the GNSO will need to do their work to come back to the council, etc. So it's not, there is no pressure.
Thanks, Chris and Fadi. No heat implied. Really, the issue here is, for me, is actually it almost goes to the trust thing. It's what should we expect of one another? Because if our expectation is 3 weeks, then it shouldn't happen. If we no longer are operating on that three-week principle, then it can happen. I sort of don't mind, really, and I'll probably get crucified for not minding, but you know, it's up to others to decide whether we observe that. I'm just noting that there was and maybe we did it even in this instance, but I'm not sure we always do. So let me not hog the mic. Brian is next.
Christina actually made my exact point, so we can go to the next person in the queue. Thank you.
Elliot.
Thank you, Jonathan. Elliot Noss, Two Cows. I think we all need remember that there is, in this room and at ICANN meetings, an overrepresentation of commercial interests and nation-state interests and law enforcement interests and businesses on all sides of the issue, and an underrepresentation of non-commercial interests, privacy interests. This report was a strong piece of work. I think that the process was a good one. But from the formation of the working group, there were serious concerns raised that there was a significant underrepresentation of privacy and non-commercial interests. And I think because of that the dissent that James referred to earlier, that Stephanie Perrin put out, need be paid special attention to, and extra attention to, and anything that happens going forward from here need explicitly call that out. I have no problem with the process and whether that was included or not. I'm not complaining about that at all. But going forward, we really need to pay attention not only to that, but to pulling in more information on the other side of this story. Thank you.
Let me just pick up on that. Elliot, thank you very much for that. I think you raise a very important point, and my mind goes immediately to, and how can we make sure that we're going to get the input that we need there. We had trouble finding people who were willing to participate originally, and Stephanie, I have to give her enormous credit. She was very earnest, and she brought a lot of expertise into the group. And personally, I found it a real joy to have her there. But as noted, she was in the minority. And so the other question is, how do we flesh that out? Do we do it through the organs that we have here and going particularly to the non-commercial user constituency or the NPOC or to ALAC, or do we, in addition, we certainly have to do all that, but in addition to that, do we reach out to organizations that specialize in that, EPIC, EFF, I'm sure there's others around the world. Specific suggestions would be very welcome from you or from others. So just to pick
that's
up
great.
On that.
That's great. So let me make a couple. Because first, you could have, the day that the working group was constituted, said that Stephanie was going to be in the minority simply by looking at the members of the group.
Yep.
That's not not, you know, everybody should bring their stuff to the table. And everybody did. And so, of course, given the constitution of the group, she's in the minority. What I'm calling out is, you know, very much, you know, what you have said and more. That makes it incumbent upon the process, however it's going to be carried. You know, Fadi said they're waiting for a direction from the GNSO. Then that exact type of reaching out need be done. That's great. So let me speak to the council. Speak to the EFF. Speak to EPIC. Go out and cultivate that information. Go out and bring that information into the process, because it was underrepresented in the working group, and it was a lone voice in the wilderness. So I think that's right, Steve. I mean, you came up with two great ones there right off the cuff. I mean, I'm happy to take away and think of a number more, but that's exactly what need be done.
Sorry, I'm going to need to respond to this. I just want to, Elliot, I appreciate the what you said, but I think that's a little unfair to characterize it that way, because what it does is it undermines the willingness of everybody else on the experts working group to listen to the input from those who come from a privacy background, and to make real compromises in order to get everybody across the line. To suggest that you know, a person or a group is always going to be in a minority. Is an unfair characterization on the efforts put in by others to actually come to the center, to the party, and to reach compromise.
Then, Chris, you didn't hear me. What I said was looking at the specific constitution of this specific group, that was an easy conclusion to come to. You generalized it, and I agree with what you've said there. That's right. So again, and I don't want that to be a, you know, well, that was poorly constituted. It was what it was. And I think everybody did do good work. Everybody brought themselves to the process. But here we are. And it was as many feared it would be.
So taking the point that Chris is making and the point that you're making, one of the things that I think is absolutely incumbent on all of us is to look at the substance of what's said, as opposed to simply looking at the list of people who were there and saying, well, that's a political process and we weren't represented, therefore we don't subscribe to the result. That's not acceptable. This was a serious piece of technical work looking at a hard set of issues, and the work should stand on its own authorship irrespective. And I would counsel everybody involved, because as Chris said, a bunch of very smart and capable and determined to be objective people looking at a full range of issues there. Yep. And as much sensitivity of privacy and everything else across the board. Stephanie brought particular expertise, but that was listened to and did not run counter to the ethic and instincts of everybody. It was simply an addition to that. I saw Shireen, you had your hand.
There's a queue now, Steve. Elliot, I've got to, your point, I think, is made. So.
But did Shireen want to respond on this?
So there's a question. I've got in the queue, I've got David, Ray, Shireen, and John, and I've got Folker asking for a direct response on this, and John. So we'll have Folker and John, and then we'll get back to the queue, which is David, Ray, and Shireen.
Thank you, Jonathan. Folker speaking. I've raised this point before, and I will chime in with what Elliot said. I can, in my view, needs to do a better job reaching out to those constituencies, interests, whatever you may call them, that are currently not represented or not coming to ICANN for whatever reasons there are, and try to activate those interests, be it privacy officials, contact them through the GAC, ask the GAC member to provide contacts to the direct data privacy officials, so that you or whenever a working group is constituted may reach out to them and say, tell them this is going on, this may affect your interests, inform them better, involve them earlier, and reach out to these to these parties because they have a lot of their on their plate as it is, and they might not see that something is going on which might be relevant to their interests. So outreach, two parties not representative represented currently might be a solution here as well.
John?
Thank you, Jonathan. If this were 2004, I would be very receptive to Elliot's point. But it's 2014, and many of the companies that were represented on who had members on this expert working group have had a history of dealing with, responding to, modifying their policies on the basis of government intervention, NGO intervention, lawsuits, and otherwise. I believe that companies are far more incorporate far more the care of data protection and privacy in their practices, and I wouldn't want to suggest that the lessons of the last 10 years were somehow thrown out once they went into the room to discuss the RDS.
So to remind you of the queue, we're going back into the queue now. We've got David, Ray, Shireen, and then back to the microphone. David.
Yeah. So, ICANN, often we have a great tendency to focus on the issue, the specific issue at hand. I think this is one example, and other examples would be to do with the RAA and other things that really demonstrate that ICANN, both as an organisation and as a community, could really benefit a great deal from serious capacity building in its ability to deal with the ever-growing complexities of international privacy policy. It is a very specialist, complicated area. People like Stephanie, who have literally decades of experience dealing with it, are wonderful, but there are very few of them around. And that is, so I think, and I'm glad to hear from what Steve said, that it appears that is a message that the board understands, that we need to do some capacity building on privacy. I know that as a stakeholder group, we realise that we are particularly interested in this area, and we are trying to do it. We have a privacy discussion hosted by the NCSG from 3 to 6 in this room, I think, on Wednesday. 3 to 6 on Wednesday, but that is only part of it. We, as Volker said, we need to also look at national privacy, data protection and privacy agencies through the GAC. We need to possibly, as an organisation, think about when we are looking for policy staff. This is something we need to, an area we need to fill. Just capacity building on privacy law is something we should be. We should definitely think about how we can best do it within this crucial process of replacing who is. And, of course, we all know who is was made with some quite, as was said in the EWG, made with some quite perhaps naive assumptions about privacy, but in practice, for the time, seemed quite reasonable. It's only that we are still sort of stuck with them so long after that is really the problem. And, we need to step up all over, and I encourage everyone to sort of participate, reach out to anyone you know, and absolutely that includes people from companies like Facebook and Google, who have a huge expertise in dealing with modern privacy things as well. All of us, we need to reach out and get privacy people involved, please.
Thanks, David. Ray.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'd like to bring this topic back to what's presented to us to discuss. First of all, Chuck, you're right on. It can't be an omnibus policy. It's got to be a group of them. And Ari, thank you very much for your intervention in regards to what's going on in the ITF. And if there's more work that needs to be done there, certainly it should be. As far as next steps along the line, this is an effort that requires, first of all, an understanding of the report. And so, Christine, I empathize with you with regard to that. I would expect to hear from you this week, but not about this. So, yes, it has to be understood by everyone that's going to be involved in discussing the policies around this report. So that's going to require probably a little extraordinary effort in the fact that you may want to sit down and construct a policy development plan. In other words, what kinds of data you need to gather, what kinds of policies could be extracted from this report as far as policy development work, come up with the policies that will be needed as a part of an overall collection of policies that will implement as appropriate and as the community desires this report. Now, you don't have to accept everything that's in the report. You can reject it. There's nothing that says that this is the solution. There may be some things where the GNSO might want to work through getting some more technical work done inside the IETF. There may be things that are implied tasks that would come out of analyzing this report in terms of policies that are not immediately apparent. So a lot of hard work, upfront analysis and description, putting together a framework as far as what types of policies are going to be appropriate is probably the best way to go. And the best people to do that are the members of the GNSO. If there's some things in there where you think that there might be a need for some additional guidance, certainly frame the question and send it to the board. But for the most part, at this point, the board should actually not be involved in your policy development process. It's yours. And so the final outcome of this will be dependent upon how well everyone amongst the entire GNSO can work together to develop a cohesive set of policies. If you need to bring in more voices, if you need to do that, fine, do it. But the board is not going to try and solve these kinds of problems for you. So in the end, we're leaving it up to you to decide what you want to do. You know, as far as I'm concerned, if you don't like the report at all, reject the entire thing. Do something else. But the point is, you need to come up with a policy. Thank you.
Thanks, Ray. We'll take two more contributions from people who've patiently waited, and then we'll probably close this topic and move on to one of the others. Shireen.
I have a concern that this, which I consider as, whichever way you look at it, a computer-based project eventually, going to hit the policy versus implementation issue big time, unless someone, and I don't know who at this stage, lay the various steps towards what I call now the working group is doing a user requirement, right? And then it's going to be handed over for the GNSO to do a policy, and then suddenly it's going to jump to implementation. And I've said this before, there is a stage missing in the middle from user requirement to implementation called design. Who's going to do that design, and who, more importantly, is going to sign off on the design? And the sign-off is a step missing in our culture generally on the design stage. And what will typically happen here is that the PDP will be done, it will be handed over, but it will not be at a level that you can go and build your database directly. There has to be a design in between. So who's going to do the design and who's going to sign off on the design? Usually, the users who own the system are the people who sign off on the design. All right? So you need to think about that. That's just a suggestion. You don't need to answer it now, but it's something that is missing from our cycle as a group.
Shireen, thanks. It's something you and I have discussed one-to-one. I've heard you talk about it publicly. I feel strongly about this specification design implementation issue. Clearly, one of the other sort of identical parallel themes is the iterative nature of those in modern development work. I mean, I do think that you raise a point here that's the reason I want to just make sure we capture it is it's not only relevant to the expert working group. It's relevant, as you said, to policy implementation work. I know Chuck is here. I wouldn't be surprised if Jay Scott was here as well, co-chairs of the Policy and Implementation Working Group. So I just want to get it on record that this is a challenge for us as a community rather than only and specifically in relation to this work. Just a reminder to... You want to respond, Bruce?
I just want to raise that, I guess, Shireen has mentioned one development methodology which is often referred to as waterfall style, where you have a very clear requirements, design, build. Quite a number of other things that we do probably follows more of an agile approach, which is develop something, get feedback, improve it. And I think we probably need to understand both of those aspects, because in either case, someone's got to be signing off on the changes. Yeah.
And that's what I meant when I meant it's iterative. So just a reminder for board members, councillors, and anyone else, announce yourself before you speak.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Christo Helas for somewhat multi-stakeholder model because I do some NGO, also some academia and business. I just wanted to raise the concern of, I'm sure that you have somehow addressed this issue in the report, and that is the question when you have introduced a model of gated kind of privileged access to the Whois database. So have you considered and how have you solved the issue of defining the for example, law enforcement actors in globally, because as you know, you have a lot of institutions which might be considered law and enforcement agencies, which are actually not, and other vice versa. So, who would be actual institute in your proposal to grant and revoke those permissions? Thank you.
Would anyone like to respond to that, or shall we? All right. So that's very usefully, it seems, I hope, Steve, aired the issue in and around the output of the expert working group to the extent that any of us have had the chance to digest it properly or even preliminarily. So I hope that's been useful, Steve and Chris and board colleagues, for a sort of preliminary pass on how we might deal with the work, Fadi. Great. So we had a couple of other topics in here. There really are three others that we could touch on. I'm going to suggest that we focus on one first and perhaps skip one entirely. So it seems to me that board engagement and involvement and also the interrelationship with GNSO board seats is something we could usefully discuss. I don't think this is unduly contentious. I think it's just useful to share our perspectives on this, whatever they may be, so that we have as close to a common understanding as possible. That is the nature of this topic to me. But there are some points in here. I personally, point number four, which is all about volume, workload, demand, and bottom up, I think we've had a good airing of those issues through the course of today and over the weekend. So my temptation is to leave that and make sure that we do cover the IDN development and adoption point. So, but first, before we get on to IDN development adoption, and if anyone has a problem with that sort of tweaking of the agenda, please let us know. Let's go into this issue of board engagement and involvement of the community and talk through and around any of those issues. And like I say, I don't want to focus simply on the interrelationship between the fiduciary duty of a director and the appointment from the GNSO. I think that teases out an underlying theme, which is what we can reasonably, what the community can expect of board member involvement in the community, how community interests are represented at board level, and to try and discuss some of those issues for which there are a series of questions. So I'm open-minded as to how we discuss that. You know, for example, Bruce, is, I think you chair the governance committee, do you? I mean, you may want to make some remarks. Others within the GNSO may want to come up with questions or statements in and around this. I don't want to prescribe the course of this discussion. This is an opportunity to have what I think is a relatively uncontentious discussion, but certainly might tease out a couple of either sensitive or interesting points. Anyone want to lead on this?
I'd like to, I don't know if I want to lead, but I want to make a couple of remarks. There is a long-running dichotomy of points of view about the board. It's quite obvious that the board is structured as a somewhat large group compared to ordinary boards, and draws people from specifically from different parts of the community. That's beneficial in terms of bringing expertise in, but it also raises, as I said, a kind of dichotomy. Is the board a traditional board that oversees the financial and managerial health of the organization, or is the board a representative body that is bringing the cross currents of the different constituencies in for thrashing out from a policy point of view? The answer, my answer, and we can have a full discussion on that, is that it is only the first. that the policy resolution issues should take place in the policy bodies, of which the GNSO is clearly one of the major ones. The role of the board is to oversee the processes, oversee the that things are going well, to help set strategic direction, and hold the management accountable in a number of different ways. And that with that point of view, every single person who joins the board, even including liaisons, in my view, who don't have a vote, everybody who sits in that room has a responsibility to act on behalf of what's good for the ICANN community as a whole and the ICANN Corporation as a business. And the idea that we're more like a parliament or that you bring the interests of a particular group into that room is, in my view, not consistent with the official duties. It's certainly valuable. It's enormously valuable to have the experience of coming from different communities. We have people who have legal experience. We have people who have policy experience. We have people who have government experience. We have people, even a few of us, who have some technical experience. All of that is very helpful. But having that experience is not the same as being the spokesperson for that community in competition, if you will, with other things. So the kind of people that we need on the board are people who have the maturity, the experience level, and the point of view and the skill sets to operate in that mode. What we ask of every single group that brings people onto the board, whether it's the NOMCOM or whether it's a supporting organization or ALAC or any of the advisory committees that are appointing non-voting liaisons, is to send people who come with the maturity level and the skills and the commitment to operate in that mode. And we ask equally of each of the appointing organizations to keep in mind that that's the role and the job that the person is doing, as opposed to being their lobbyist, if you will, or their spokesperson. There are many other avenues for communicating your points of view, formal and informal alike. So that's my opening salvo, and I will step back from this. And Bruce, you will bring a calmer point of view here.
Well, certainly, I think Ray Polzak's used the terminology here that when you're coming from the GNSO or the ASO or the CCNSO, what you bring to the board is a perspective from that group, but you're not representing the group. And that's because the board's not a parliament. It is actually a corporate board, and the board's responsibility, is set out in the corporation's law or the law of the way the organisation is structured. But having said that, just to sort of give you a feel for how it practically works, I have been elected by the GNSO. In fact, I think I'm the longest-serving voting board director currently. My approach to this has been that I follow the activities of the GNSO. I'm on the GNSO Council mailing list. I read all your postings. And typically, when a matter comes before the board, the way the board structures its process is it appoints what we call shepherds to actually take that issue, help answer questions from other board directors, help liaise with staff on that particular issue. So when, for example, the output of a PDP comes from the GNSO to the board, it's typically me or Bill Shepherd that takes on and shepherds that issue. We'll have read the PDP report. If any board directors have any questions, we will attempt to answer them from our own personal knowledge of the topic. If we can't answer them, we would help engage the staff to help answer the board's questions. Or even suggest people in the community that board directors could speak to if they wanted to understand something further. So that's certainly how we look at those issues. I attend various direct meetings with stakeholder groups. I met with the commercial stakeholder group this morning with Bill Graham. Also was on a call a few weeks ago with the registry stakeholder group. In each case, I listen to what those groups have to say. I summarise their comments and I send those comments to the board mailing list for all board directors to read. So just sort of giving you a bit of a feel for this is how it works in practice. So I'm not seeing this an issue. I'd be interested to hear why you think it's a problem. But I think the GNSO council members, the GNSO elected members of the board do keep in close touch with the GNSO community. And fundamentally, our role is to make sure we fully understand the issues and the policies that are being brought forward to the board. But the board as a whole meets and votes on those, and we work through those documents that you provide us. I hope that helps a bit, but I'm not really seeing any conflicts or problems in this area personally.
So we have a hand up from Olga. Let's hear from you, Olga.
Thanks, and thank you for putting this in the agenda, because it really, it's a way for us to be able to discuss how it is that the board comes to consensus on things. One of the most important jobs of the board members is to try to reach consensus on things that sometimes represent very differing views among the different communities. If the character of the obligation of the board member were to change from one where you primarily must take into account the good of the entire organization, then what you would have instead is the type of board where each board member would represent the viewpoints of, let's say, their particular community or, let's say, shareholders. In that kind of a board, then what you would have is a lesser ability to resolve between differing viewpoints. You would simply have a restatement at the board level of views that have differed within the community. So I think right now it has a very traditional structure in terms of a nonprofit organization with an obligation of every board member to the entire organization, and that actually is serving us quite well.
Thanks, Olga. I've got Ray and then possibly James. I wouldn't mind making some remarks as well. So go ahead, Ray.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'd like to echo comments that Bruce has made and Olga has made. From a perspective of an SO-appointed board member, I do keep myself aware of what goes on in the regional registries. I subscribe to all five of those registries' policy lists and so forth. I regularly attend the council meetings, the address council, as does Quo Way. We both do that. We periodically attend RAR policy meetings, which, by the way, are in every sense of the word an ICANN meeting, and the fact that that's where the policy development work takes place in those parts, in that community. So, but I never really argue the perspective of the ASO, unless I think it is probably the perspective that is best for the entire organization. More often than not, I will be arguing from the perspective of some other part of the community in what I think is best for the entire organization. Olga makes a very good point with regards to type of board. If we were to be viewed and be expected to act as representatives, you are setting the board up for failure, because we would never reach consensus. We would always be involved in protecting the special interests of the group that sent us there. And we would have to negotiate. We would probably have to get some kind of an arbiter at times to settle matters. And so it is much better for us to do what we do, which is look at the organization as a whole, look at the corporate organization as a whole, and work to reach consensus on what we as a collective body think is best for the organization. That's why I hope you put us there, and that's why I hope you continue to support us in that endeavor.
It makes me think your job is easier than that of a GNSO councillor, whose job it is to represent their groups. But I see we've got James. Are you still in?
So thanks, and I think it's helpful to hear this feedback, these perspectives on how the individual board members view their role and their responsibility to the greater community and not just the constituencies that send them. I have a question as a non-board member in this vein, and perhaps this is a little out of date, but I do recall at some point there was some discussions about certain board members then being asked to recuse themselves from certain issues that might affect their stakeholder group. Now, I'm trying to reconcile the earlier part of this conversation with the idea that that just in case a board member might want to represent a stakeholder group, they have to be you know, sidelined from voting on certain issues. Is that still an occurrence? And if so, can you help me understand how they mesh with the idea that board members serve the entire community?
Thanks, James. I'm glad you surfaced that point. And just for the clarity of everyone, that is what point D on this slide means. It's understanding that relationship where you're sufficiently removed from that because you're acting wholly in the interest of the corporation, then how to understand why any kind of conflict of interest might persevere.
Right, and if I can be just provocative for a minute, if that is truly a concern, sufficient of a concern, that someone would have to be recused, then is that person suitable for the board, hypothetically? It seems like those two principles are at odds.
So I think I think it would be helpful for Bruce and I both to respond, and maybe others. I'll make mine very short. We recuse ourselves when we have a personal conflict that is focused on the appearance or sometimes even the fact of financial or quite similar, but it's much narrower than I'm from this community and this is of interest to the community and therefore I shouldn't have anything to say about it. Not that at all. But I think it would be helpful to hear multiple voices on this.
So we've got a bunch. Mike, I've got a queue here of responses, but if Shireen, you were on this topic as well, Patrick should defer to you first.
Okay. The role of a director is to act in the collective interest of all stakeholders, not a single stakeholder. And the test is at the time you make a decision, because it's all in your head. At the time you make a decision, are you able to make a decision in the collective interest of all the stakeholders, not a single one? My observation on the board that this is happening, I come from a NOMCOM, so I don't represent it, this is happening, and my observation is I've not seen people recusing themselves because they fear of a conflict with a particular SO or AC organization. The recuse, as Steve has said, is usually on a personal level. So, for example, we're making a decision about an application for a new GTLD and someone has a commercial interest. So this is right. It's a personal conflict, not an organizational conflict. Thank you.
Can I respond very quickly, Jonathan? I'm sorry. Because this was very helpful, the distinction between a personal conflict. And I would point out that if this is the case where a board member is recusing themselves, then I think that is, you know, responsible and a respectful thing to do for the integrity of the institution. But my concern would be is if there was a vote where the rest of the board or some outside structure or some other organization would ask a board member to recuse themselves. Is that something that's ever occurred?
Let's leave the responses then in the queue that we've got them, which is Bruce, Chris, and Mike. And if it's not satisfactorily answered, come up with.
Yeah, I mean, generally, James, it is standard practice on a board that you have a board of conflict of interest policy which is published, and as Shireen said, you look at that on each decision and whether you have a personal interest. Now that could be direct financial or it could be indirect in that, you know, maybe your wife or someone like that's directly involved, or it can be perceived. And we actually have a conflicts and ethics subcommittee that looks at that in each case and makes a determination. Where we moved beyond just doing it on a case-by-case basis was for new GTLDs. And the view was that, really from a board efficiency point of view, the feeling was that there was a pretty heavy workload for a couple of years really now that's been on new GTLDs generally. And there were board directors, including myself, that do have commercial interests in the new GTLD area. I work for a registrar, as you know. Now, that's not in the case of all GTLDs, and in fact, in many cases, I'm involved in looking at reconsideration requests, and like the vast majority of those have absolutely nothing to do with our company. They're completely immaterial. When they do, I individually recognise those, and I recuse myself from that specific instance. So the fact that we did that in the new GTLD committee was really an efficiency thing, because otherwise every single meeting we'd have to do an analysis of 20-odd board members to decide which TLDs could they be affected by and not. And you know, making some specific ruling for brand TLDs, for example, which board directors have involvements in brand TLDs and which don't. So it was predominantly done for efficiency reasons. But the standard conflicts policy is on each case, we look to see if there's a direct conflict of interest with that particular TLD or that particular office lease that we might be signing or particular employee that's being hired, you know, all of those things, we look at those individually. That makes sense. But for me, myself, the vast majority of stuff that's come through from the GNSO, I haven't recused myself. It's only when it's been something that I can directly identify. I did it in the case of Triple X, where that came to the board for decision. And I made the call that probably was going to make a material difference to the income of Melbourne IT, my employer. Didn't have a direct influence on me. I didn't get paid more or less, but the perception would be that I get some benefit from that. So I recused myself on the decision of Triple X.
Thanks, Bruce. We've got responses from Chris and Mike as well. Okay, Chris, thanks. Mike, are we good?
Thanks. I think it's a very useful discussion and one that we have repeatedly on the board, so I'm glad to see it's happening over here. And I think the critical thing is that we need to be more transparent, because we often desperately need the input of people coming from ACs and SOs to guide us on some of these issues, because we maybe do not understand the nuance. We can get a staff paper, but the 10-year history, and Bruce is the most brilliant historian on GNSO issues, but we often need a deeper understanding than can be conveyed in a staff briefing paper. And that's when our colleagues are absolutely essential, and we shouldn't lose that. As we look through our changes in accountability structures, we shouldn't look at that. What will often happen, and there are three elements or there are three opportunities for recusal. So the first, and it's set out in our conflicts policy, the first is that you indicate where you're coming from, and in the voting, everybody knows, for example, it's a vote on a redelegation, Chris and I are appointed by the CCNSO, it's obvious that we have an interest in the area, and that's adequate, and simply by putting in your statement of interest and updating it annually, that is generally qualified. If people may have missed an issue about it, you may choose to disclose it. The second issue is where you have a conflict which would lead you to prefer either to not vote or to abstain, but for you to participate in the discussion because you can add value. However, either we or you yourself personally or in discussion with General Counsel and the Board Governance Committee may choose not to cast a vote on an issue or abstain on an issue, but you make your voice known, you give the Board assistance by giving history, and then obviously the most complex is where you step out of the room because the conflict is so clear and precise. So the question is, do the SOs and ACs then present us with people who have no conflict, no interest in anything that's going on in ICANN? And potentially we then have people who are so vanilla that you may as well not appoint, we give everybody to the NomCom. And as we've seen, and around this table, there are some superb directors who've come through the nominating committee, but they lack the history and they lack the nuance in most cases. And we try and balance that on the board. The governance committee tries to achieve that balance, but it's something that does need to be looked at. One of my colleagues will talk about the German model where you separate an oversight board and a policy board or an operational board. There are dozens of ways of doing it. But what I'm saying is please don't take the expertise away from us. Really please, because without it, we're at the mercy of very one-dimensional documentation that we then have to rely on for decisions.
Thanks, Mike. And I've spoken publicly on this, as thinking from a contracted party's point of view. I mean, we need the expertise, practical, operational expertise at board level as well. Personally, I've had experience of this issue via, for example, years on the board at Nominet, where member-elected
directors have to deal with a very similar position, but I'm not sure all of us have had the chance to A, experience this, and B, none of us are as aware as you are of the time you spend discussing this, figuring this out, working it out. So from my point of view, it was critical to have this discussion and kind of air it. And one thing we haven't touched on, and we've got just coming up for 10 minutes, but we do want to go to a final issue, but is a perception that the board used to be in some way more engaged with the community. I think we've touched on that peripherally in talking about these issues and how, for example, Bruce talked about tracking issues yourself, Ray and others. So I think, but whether or not we spend a couple of minutes discussing that, that was one of the final thread. Nevertheless, I think this has been a very, very constructive discussion, and personally feel that it's very useful to be able to have got some of this out for us to simply understand better and hear where the challenges in perception might be. Is anyone feel that an issue either that we highlighted on the agenda and or from the board that needs a final item of clarification or point, or are we satisfied that we've aired this thoroughly? Wonderful. Well, we're on track then. We've 10 minutes to go, and we aim to finish respectful of your busy agenda. But there is a final point we wanted to raise on the issue, and I'll let you lead on that, Ching, on the issue of IDN development and adoption. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Jonathan. And my name is Ching Chiao from the Registry Stakeholder Group. The title is the development and the adoption. For the sake of time, we'll focus on the development part, which is the IDN VIP projects. And just let me start by saying that the GNSO welcomes and appreciates the progress that's being made on the VIP project. This variant issue has been historical, just like the Who Is One, which we just talked about. But it seems to me at the personal level, and some may share the concern, is that the urgency and the priorities sit kind of a bit lower than the EWG, which is under the spotlight. But nevertheless, with the slowdown of, the slowdown stage of the IDN CCTO, the fast track, I think our works on the IDN GTODs, some launched, in operation already, needs to be speed up more. During the our weekend session, the council and the staff have a very productive discussion on the IDN VIP project. We particularly interested in the progress on the project 2.2, which is the label generation rules, which this reached its certain milestone, which we're very glad to know. But somehow project number 7, which is more policy implementation and delegation, which is a kind of a bit unknown to us, but also critically important to us, but also for the TOD operators. So perhaps the board, like what you have done for the EWG, maybe can give us a heads up on how we, as a council or the community, should be prepared for the policy-related works, as it is this VIP project is a board designated one, and which potentially requires the policy change on the IDN delegation, also operation. And furthermore, on the bigger scope, is the council also interested in how the ICANN right now coordinates the work on the top level and also on the second level, which now follows the IDN current guidelines. This to help ensure the industries continue to engage and to protect the users from the security risk. So let me stop here and let...
So, Ching, thanks. I've got Mike Silber and Ram. Anyone else? And Kuwe.
Thanks for raising, a very important issue. It's one that at the moment, and Ram and Kuwe will talk more about in terms of the board IDN variant working group. What we've noticed, though, is a perception that there wasn't enough attention being paid to universal acceptance. And I think the two issues go hand in hand. The one is the technical, the second is the policy, and then the third is taking it out. So you would have seen, I think, a really good piece of staff work in terms of the universal acceptance paper that came out last week. It's a good paper, but I think it is a little short on detail. And part of the reason why it's short in detail is because we need people to start filling in and colouring in some of the detail. Again, it's not attempting to be prescriptive, but it's also indicating that steps need to be taken. Given that the working group is a highly technical working group, and I'm a complete incompetent when it comes to technical issues, the risk committee is taking on acceptance while we're looking for a home for it. There may be a more appropriate home, but for now we're holding on to it, and we're looking at initiatives, opportunities of working with staff around universal acceptance. And then I'm particularly passionate about finding ways to incubate where I can provide an opportunity to incubate interested parties, people with skin in the game. Because the problem with ICANN is we don't make money out of this, or very little. We need people who can actually take this and exploit it commercially going forward, and we need to give them the little push and the nudge to say, run. Take your communities and run with it, because if it's commercially viable, people will run with it, and we need to find ways to help make it viable and increase that adoption. But let me hand over to the colleagues who are actually more technically proficient, and they would obviously have a deeper understanding.
Ram, Kuwei, and Edmund. Ram.
Thank you, Jonathan. And Ching, thank you very much for bringing this up. Ram Mohan, I chair the Board Variant Working Group. Two comments to start with. First of all, the board views the work on IDNs and IDN variants to be very important, and continues to provide both time as well as resources to ensure that project and the projects that come up as a result of it are properly funded and get the level of attention that they require. That has been a commitment from the board for years now, and that will continue to be in that same direction. The second thing is that it's also important to get it right. So that has been a significant focus, and the direction that the board has been providing to staff. And it's something that we have to provide to the community as well. The work that's being done here, there is a pretty good opportunity to rush the work and to get pieces of it that are not just right. And in these cases, there is no opportunity to unring the bell. So the focus is on going in a conservative manner and in a very structured, disciplined approach to the work that is going on. We have here Sarmad Hussain, who is the staff lead on the project. Sarmad, could you speak just briefly to the first question, which has to do with the implementation of the 2.2 and Project 7, and then between Kuwei and I will cover the rest of the topics.
Thank you. So there are two implementation projects, P2.2, which is the generation of label generation rule set, and P7, which is eventually the implementation of variants. So we are actually currently executing Project 2.2, which actually takes the Unicode code points, that subset of Unicode code points which are p-valid, protocol valid, and selects a subset of those code points which can actually go or which are allowed in the root zone. The process for developing this label generation rule set was developed and is now being followed through. As steps for this process, step number one was developing a maximal starting repertoire, which was released on 20th June, so about 2 days ago. That work actually has taken about almost a year in making. It analyzed 97,973 code points, which are p-valid or context sense O or J, and shortlisted 32,790 code points and covered 22 scripts. There's still about 6 scripts left, which will be covered in the second phase of MSR towards the end of this year. And now this MSR is the starting point, and this has been handed over to the communities. Communities are actually developing their generation panels. So currently we have an Arabic generation panel, a Chinese generation panel is being formed, and then we have Korean and Japanese generation panels and Neo-Brahmi generation panel in the process. And as soon as these generation panels are formed and they give more concrete recommendation on which part of this MSR is actually going to go into LGR, and those are incorporated into the LGR, we go into the next phase, which is Project 7, which is implementation of that LGR. So that's what the status is right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarmad.
Just a time check for you. I'm just noting that we're getting close to time.
Understood. So I think the short form of the answer to question one is Project 7 is in many ways dependent upon the prior project getting to a good state. We're not there yet. When we get there, I think we'll have much better answers for what we do with Project 7. To the second question, the answer is yes. The council should get prepared for policy-related work. It's going to come. But in terms of rough guidelines, I'd say probably first quarter of 2015 is what it feels like might be about the right time when this kind of work will start to come through your way. And to the third question, I think it's a great question that you've raised. The IDN guidelines at the second level, that work was done a while ago, but it has not been touched up, if you will, or looked at in recent times. I think it's entirely appropriate to start to look at how to streamline and coordinate the work between what's being done at the top level and at the second level. So that's a great suggestion. It's something that we should work together on.
We've got Kuwe and Edmund, and then we'll draw to close. We've come to the end of our time, so just to bear that in mind.
I think a lot of GNSO people, you might be just know the IDM variants, but you are not really take really detailed to look at the problem and complexity of the IDM variants. Particularly, just 1 week before I fly into the London, the trademark lawyer come to me to complain or they worry about the policy will impact them. So in here, in the GNSO, I know you have a lawyer here, you have a commercial constituency people here. I'd like to let you aware what is the IDM variant will be impact to your company or your clients. Let's take an example like a Chinese characters. Many Chinese companies in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Macau, Singapore, even in China, before they choose the name for their company in Chinese characters, they always go to the fortune teller to calculate the numbers of the stock of their Chinese characters. Because that numbers of the stock in that Chinese character for their company's name can be mean very fortune or very bad. That take one example, like 30, the combination of the number of the stock, 32, is good. But if you go to the 34, it's very bad. And that is not only for the company name. If you are choosing the Chinese characters, or you have a company registered in Hong Kong, Taiwan, whatever, you will face that problems, like a Coca-Cola. The second problem is not only the company name, including the family names. Every Chinese family, when they choose the name for their kids, they always go to the fortune teller to calculate the number of the stock, the same as the company name. Now, for IDM variants, because they try to match the traditional character and simplified characters. So what they did is one of the proposals, of course, it's not final yet, but I saw one of the proposal say you can you the variant name list is only can choose one character from the whole traditional characters. For example, the flower or something like that, you know. In Chinese, you have a 5 or 6 way to write the characters. But the problem is that the number of the stroke is different. And so, if my company choose this character for my company name or my family names, it's not be chosen based on the panel generation policy that is recommended. It's not in the list. If you are not in the list, that means it's abandoned. Okay? Then, original, your company name is these two characters combined. It's a good fortune. Unfortunately, one of the characters is not in the list. You have no choice. You have to choose what the panel generation developer for you, another characters. Then you combine these two characters. Your company go into bankrupt. And I don't know how you can resolve that. This is a very deep cultural issue in the company name, family name using in Chinese community all over the world. So I really urge for GNSO peoples, don't thought about IDM variants is not impact to you. It is. It's very critical. And so it's very difficult, and we need to look carefully to work it out, all kind of possibility. And important thing is in the panel generation, it was developed, as I know, very few of the lawyer, very few of the registrant or user participate in the panel generation. It only came from the registries. Fortunately, by early of May, we have a workshop in Japan. I think the JPIS and JPNIC do very wonderful job. They invite 40-some people, including the registry, JPIS, JPNIC, and the company, and the government, and the registrant to join in together to understand the situation. So I'd like to raise this issue for you to understand we take the IDM variant very seriously. Just like Ray Ram say, it's critical and it's important, but we need to do it right. If we make the policy, eventually your company original using the Chinese character is a very fortunate to be a billionaire, and suddenly after the IDM variant decision policy defined it, you are going to bankrupt. I think your company is going to sue us. And I think that is not a good policy.
Thanks, Kuwei. I'm going to give Edmund a last word, and then we really must wrap this up for we're on very tight schedule. We've overrun here. You have Edmund.
Edmund Chung here. I'll try to be very concise. 3 points on it, actually building on what Kuowei's mentioned and what Ram mentioned in terms of making sure we do it right, and also the implications on policy. And I think Thomas mentioned that earlier in the week as well. One of the things I want to raise is to the board's attention is that currently the generation panel, especially the integration panel, in the LGR procedures document that the board passed, it specifically asked for expertise on policy to be included as advisors in the integration panel. Currently, the implementation by staff does not include that at this time. So we want to raise the issue. This is precisely what Kuowei mentioned, precisely what others have mentioned. I won't rehash all the arguments that were put in to add that into the LGR process document, but it is in there, and right now I'm bringing up to people's attention that the roster right now that we have does not include it. So we want to make sure that that's included. Second point,
Edmund, just very briefly on that, as far as I understand,
inclusion of advisors is discretionary and optional. It's not a requirement for the panels. So I just want to make sure that the record is clear that there is not a requirement for these panels to have advisors.
Agree, but I think that that's part of what was raised just now, both in Huawei and I think Thomas earlier in the week. There is an importance on having some policy expertise on the panel. So that's the point that I want to make across. And it is part of the design of the original LGR policy. So the second point that I want to bring up is, I think, what Mike mentioned about the universal acceptance. I think that's very important. I want to bring your attention to, again, the JIG report, the joint IDN group between the CCNSO and GNSO report. It was passed on from the two councils to the board. Board hasn't really, doesn't seem like the board has made any decisions on it or accept it or not. I know the latest document references it, but the question is whether the board will consider that report and whether we will accept those recommendations. The third point I want to go back to, I guess, what Ram mentioned, I very much encourage to revisit the, it's time to revisit the IDN guidelines, and part of the JIG report points to that as well. And also the project number 7 is extremely important because for those who don't know, that's a project where we talk about how the variant, if there is a variant, how it's put into the zone and in the route and what the process is in terms of delegation. And that has potential implications on the applicant guidebook, maybe addendum or some kind of changes to that, as well as the CCTLD fast track and the CCTLD general IDN process. So that I understand that has some dependency, but I think we've passed the point that there will be, very likely will be, variants, so let's get that work started sooner.
Jonathan, very briefly, may I, this is really a substantive set of discussions and perhaps needs much broader discussion. May I invite the GNSO Council and your representatives to come and engage with the staff as well as the BBWG, the Board Variant Working Group. Let's set up a session and let's get through all of these topics and let's drive this to something that's useful for the entire community.
Thanks, John. We'll take that on as an action to move that forward. That's great.
Jonathan, can I, very short, one. As I know, the IDM workshop will be happening in the, I think it's the day after tomorrow's. If in the GNSO you are the trade lawyer or you are a commercial company, I really encourage you to go there to express that because it's critical for your companies.
You're looking at me, Jonathan, so I guess I get to wrap up. Thank you. Two things. Vasian, let me introduce you. Will you stand up for just a second? We have a new addition to our board support resources group. Vasian Konigsfeld has joined us, and we now have a and Wendy Prophet moved over from another part of the organization, so we now have a much fuller group that's working with the board. And echoing what was said earlier about the staff that supports the GNSO, we too at the board are extremely impressed with the quality of the staff and the energy and commitment that we see across the board in the policy support group, in the board resources group, and throughout the rest of the organization. I wanted to share that with you. And in closing, I think we've accomplished what I always considered the primary goal, which is to make sure that we use the time in a substantive and meaningful way. I think we dove right in and we got to a bunch of things that were important. So I hope that you feel as well served as I know that we are. And the number of action items out of this and some very good ideas to think about. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Steve.